the OTB Podcast Network.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Let's go straight to that boxing story then. We are joined by Ronan Mullen this morning. How are you getting on, Ronan?
All's well, Owen. How are you?
All good. Will we just dip straight into that question that Jer posed there about the heavyweights and what Saturday night does, how we're looking in that division for the next little while?
Yeah, well, it's spot on that the top three heavyweights sort of have a clear path. The top three that I think most people would land on would be Fury, Joshua and Wilder. But I think before Saturday, there was a very strong case that Dillian White had almost usurped Wilder in that number three position, just given the resume he's put together since he fought Joshua coming on 5 years ago. But now that has cleared up. But it does speak to the depth of the heavyweight division, something that's been absent probably since the turn of the century, where not only have we got that nice podium of really top champions, we've also got this brilliant tier of challengers coming through. And there's another one below, young up-and-comers, probably most notably Daniel Dubois, one of Frank Warren's charges, who's already blistering through the up-and-coming ranks. So the next couple of years promise to be incredible. And for the first time possibly ever, Britain seems to be the center point for the heavyweight division. And as you touched on there a couple of minutes ago, it seems like the path has been cleared for that Joshua Fury fight. Should they overcome their next two fights? Fury's would seem trickier on paper, obviously, against Wilder, who's just got that concussive knockout power of his own in the right hand. And then Joshua has Kubrat-Pulev, who's a pretty decent operator, but at this point of his career, you'd think Joshua should get the job done. The only thing the caveat you'd put there is Joshua hasn't fought in a long time. You know, he rematched Andy Ruiz in December of last year, and it will be December of this year before he gets back in the ring. So ring rust notwithstanding, I think those two should get the job done. And then possibly next summer, it'll be Joshua against Fury.
That's a long way away still, notwithstanding the fact that we don't know what's going to happen behind closed doors, if these fights can actually happen. Are the next two fights definitely going to happen this year, irrespective of whether or not there are crowds allowed, or what is the situation with that?
Yeah, so Joshua and Pulev was supposed to happen a few weeks ago at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. And as you said, the absence of crowds kind of put the knockers on that. And I think most fighters have come around to the idea of fighting behind closed doors. Joshua, given the huge gate receipts he draws in, was understandably less forthcoming in that regard and probably was trying to delay the decision as much as he could. But by December, I think obviously Matchroom had the test event at the Crucible for the snooker, and it's obviously a very different case. But I think Eddie Hearn is going to pitch to the government basically to let boxing be the next sort of test event. There might be a crowd of some sort by December for that Joshua Pulev fight, but I think that will get done in December. The Fury Wilder one is interesting because ever since Wilder came out with that nonsense excuse about his heavy costume weighing him down in the rematch, he's been very quiet, and there's been no real pointers to when he's going to, you know, get back into action. The pandemic has obviously put that fight back a little bit too. But while we know Joshua and Pulev are getting it on December, there's still no firm date on the third fight between Wilder and Fury.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about Katie Taylor. I think a lot of people watching the fight were listening to the various commentators suggesting that Delphine Persoon was ahead, certainly going into the last two rounds. You know, I don't know if Matthew Macklin actually said that he had it that score, but whoever the other person that they went to on the commentary definitely had Persoon up by two rounds heading into the final two rounds. And that's where people's surprise about certainly one of the judges scored the fight very one-sided for Katie Taylor. Andy Lee's card had her winning by two rounds, I think. So I think that might be for people who are watching fights very sporadically, which is generally most people, why the aggression of Persoon was the thing that they're going to remember a lot from this fight. You thought Katie Taylor won the fight well.
Yeah, I thought if there was going to be a clear winner, it was Katie Taylor. Your point is fair that, you know, a two-round win for Katie Taylor, that's 6-4, and it only takes one of those rounds to be subjectively scored in the opposite direction to make it a 5-5 draw. So it was that kind of fight. I thought Katie edged it out, but, you know, it was close and competitive, and the nature of women's boxing, the two-minute rounds make for great entertainment, but it makes the rounds incredibly hard to judge because they're so frenetic and high tempo that often in over 12 three-minute rounds, there'll be lulls. It's quite clear. You can pick the quality work and rounds are quite easy to score. In that one, the judges had to earn their money because they were trying to spot the clean work amidst these incredible volleys from both fighters. I know Persoon was throwing a lot, but Katie was returning rallies in return herself. So to try and spot the actual landing clean shots was a tough errand for the lads at ringside. I thought they did a reasonably good job. Generally, the 98-93 was a bit over the top, but if you land on the correct winner, there's been so many cards where the correct winner didn't get their hand raised that I don't really mind when, as long as they land on the correct victor, yeah. I'm happy enough.
Okay. One thing I did want to ask as well is, like, so Katie Taylor has a welt on her forehead from the middle of the fight. You don't get that from a punch. You get that from a headbutt. And yeah. Also, it's sore. So there's a strong chance that the middle few rounds might have been a direct result from something that didn't happen legally. And that's the other part of this where you're like, okay, well, you know, justice would have been completely unjust if she'd taken a headbutt, which I suspect that was, because it definitely wasn't a punch. And then lost that fight afterwards.
Yeah, and she absolutely flew out of the traps. It's kind of a calling card of her professional career. She always starts fast. She's actually scored a few early knockdowns in her career. And the way it was going in the first couple of rounds, Persoon's face walking back to her corner after round two, it looked like she might not be long for this one, but it's just, she had obviously a really poor preparation for her Olympic qualifier at the start of the year. She took this fight at 7 weeks' notice, which is relatively short notice given that Katie had been pegged to fight Amanda Serrano, a similar caliber of opponent, and had been preparing basically since January. So Persoon, like, kind of belied the notion that she wouldn't go the 10 rounds. She was as high tempo in round 10 as she had been in those middle rounds where she kind of came on strong. But it's a fair point about Katie. That welt on her forehead was definitely from a head clash. And if she looked in any way disorientated, maybe in those couple of middle rounds, that was probably why. But unlike in Madison Square Garden, I thought she was the one who closed the show stronger. She was the one who picked the landing shots. And in that last 20 seconds, grandstand finish, which I'm sure will be used in Sky promo reels for years and decades to come, where the two of them are just swinging for the fences in those last 10 seconds. Like, she stood there and held her ground against a presumably or an allegedly stronger opponent and held her own. I thought it was a pretty spectacular fight for Katie Taylor and another hallmark one on her career.
Yeah, and that is the issue here, really. It's about making her be attractive in those fights enough to be able to sell in the States, where the super money comes from. Talk of a crossover fight against some of the UFC stars as well. So if you were plotting the next 12 months, and I don't know how long Katie Taylor's going to continue to box, because, like, she's 34 and she's made a lot of money and she's done literally everything that's possible for her to do. So if you were plotting the next 12 months, what conversations is Brian Peters having with her about what's next?
I do think the sky's the limit here. You mentioned she's 34, turned pro at 30, and she was world champion within 12 months. But when she fought Jessica McCaskill at the end of 2017, just over a year into her pro career, she did still seem like an elite amateur trying to parlay her skills into the professional game. And Jessica McCaskill threw the kitchen sink at her. And that win looks incredible in retrospect, given what McCaskill has gone on to do. But I think in the most recent phase of Katie's career, in the last 18 months or so, she's really established herself as a pro fighter. She's noticeably sitting down in her shots. She's flatter on her feet. She wasn't just bouncing in and out the other night. She boxed at all angles. She boxed at all distances. And I think she's set up to, like, she's already conquered the lightweight division, which would be enough for most people. She's won a title at the division above light welterweight, which sets her with Carl Frampton and Steve Collins as our only two division world champions. So the next port of call will likely be to try and make history again and be the first three-weight world champion. She's in a race with Carl Frampton for that, because Carl is fighting Jamel Herring to become a three-weight champion himself. So those two will be trying to race to the finish line to see who can make that piece of history. But that again would lead to Katie fighting McCaskill, who, somewhat incredibly, like a full-time accountant slash banker in Chicago, has segued into this remarkable professional boxing career, where, having boxed Katie Taylor, she went on and won two titles at super lightweight, beat Cecilia Brighthouse, who'd be considered one of the pound for pound greats of women's boxing last weekend, and now holds all the cards at the 147 pound division. So if Katie wants to move up there, maybe at a catch weight, and fight McCaskill again, that's a very marketable fight. You just have to watch the first one to know how competitive it was. And that would be a brilliant fight. Natasha Jonas, who you would have seen on the Sky punditry team, was not shy in maybe putting it out there that she'd be open to a fight. And she's had a bit of a renaissance herself. She boxed very well in her world title fight against Terry Harper recently. Chantel Cameron is a mandatory challenger, but I think Katie is almost beyond the whole thing of mandatory challengers. She's proved that she can win all the belts. I think she's more about maybe trying to make more history. And there's a few other ones, as you mentioned. Amanda Serrano is obviously the one I think everybody wants, given she's a prolific champion in her own right. And that's been talked about ever since Katie turned pro, really. And then, of course, Holly Holm. Again, how marketable would that be if you got the cross-promotion of Matchroom and the UFC? Chris Cyborg, who's with Bellator now, also on the DAZN platform, which Eddie Hearn has ties to. Again, great cross-promotion potential there. And less likely probably is Amanda Nunes, who's probably the best female fighter in the UFC at the moment, who said she wouldn't mind doing a little bit of boxing at some point. So there's plenty of options for Katie Taylor. I think she's going to be around for a few years, yeah.
Yeah, this is going to be a really interesting little while. Just on McCaskill, how much better is she than their first fight? Obviously, you're mentioning that the fact that that first fight in York Hall was actually a cracker. It was a really tight fight. I don't think a lot of people would have actually seen that, but she's obviously made strides forward since then as well in McCaskill.
Yeah, she's just got this... Katie made an interesting point about Prasoon where it's because she doesn't really do anything technically correct that it's almost so difficult to time her, because boxers coming through the amateur ranks have this reflexive memory where if an opponent does something, they know what to do in return. Whereas Prasoon is so unorthodox that that was a difficult read for Katie, and as was McCaskill at that point in her career, because as I said, Katie wasn't long out of the amateur game and McCaskill came with this sort of rather, I don't want to call it ungainly, but it wasn't characteristic of maybe what you'd see at the top end of professional boxing. But she's since kind of honed her craft a little bit. But what she did last week was against another elite technician in Breakhouse, she just kind of really put it on her, set an incredibly high tempo, and that's what she'd be looking to do again. She will be the bigger woman in the ring when she fights Katie Taylor, and that will be a distinct advantage. But again, I thought Katie looked stronger on her feet last Saturday night compared to maybe 14 months ago, and that will have been owed in part to her fight in November when she moved up and fought Christina Linadatu, who's another handful, but a very aggressive, sizable opponent to navigate for Taylor. And I thought she did well in November and probably put that to good use again at the weekend.
Ronan Mullen, great stuff. Thanks a million.
Thanks, lads.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.